Health and policies, before I begin, it would only be prudent for us to recognize two folks who were instrumental in the Black Caucus of Healthcare Workers. Ellis Bonner, if it wasn't for Mr. Bonner in the late 80s, early 90s, I dare say the caucus would not be able to exist because he essentially financed it out of his own pocket. Second individual, first African-American president, APHA, first graduate from U of M with a DRPH, that's Paul Cornelli. So equality and equity, just want to more or less draw your attention to those little boxes down there. In terms of equity, what we're looking at is what are those structural issues that we can take advantage of that will promote equity, meaning fairness, as opposed to equality. We're not looking at equality. It's much more important for us to look at that moral and mores issues around health equity. And of course, as you already know, in terms of public health, a core value is social justice. And for us in Cincinnati, when inequality is too great, the idea of community cannot be realized. We're looking at not necessarily race-specific policies. We're looking at what folks have already alluded to is multi-ethnic collaboration and cooperation. Without that, we would not be able to achieve the kinds of successes that we believe can take place not only in Cincinnati but in our nation. So when we look at the report, the Heckler Report, 1986, let's not just hearken in on a race-specific kind of lens, but let's look at what indeed are differences and challenges that we have in our respective communities and address those. So disparity issues more or less are around numeric differentials in terms of excess. For us, in addition to that, we're looking at what is the differential exposure to different risk factors in our respective communities. So the life course approach is very useful in that regard. Additionally, many of you have seen this particular schematic before. I would certainly, if you haven't, dig into it because here we're looking at upstream, the downstream issues around infant mortality. But this is Tony Iton and also the Prevention Institute in California. So please take a look at that. This is an important and valuable kind of schematic from which I would draw your attention to for use for application. For the African American and persons of African descent, and as well as obviously on the continent, the Sankofa bird essentially, more or less from the Ndinka community, West Africa more or less tells us there are important lessons that we can learn by looking at our past. And that additionally, in plucking out those negative things, we also want to look at and seek those positive things that can be helpful that took place in our past for use in our present and our future. So certainly, we want to know that our past conditions. If you want to know what's the issues in terms of our present conditions, we want to look at our past, right? And conversely, if you want to look at what things can be done in terms of our future conditions, let's look at present policy. Look at our present actions. What are our present actions that we do today? How will they influence our conditions in the future? So in that sense, we already, many of us here know about the roughly 126,000 voyages, slave voyages over a period of 1500 to 1870 that took place. In terms of the racial contract, Charles Mills, the idea here is that USA, most of our businesses are done via social contract, the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, etc., provided a system based on Rousseau, etc. But what Charles Mills is saying is that persons of color, as well as other individuals, native persons, etc., and other individuals like women today, possibly the homeless individuals, gay and lesbian community, sub persons. So it's extremely important and valuable to note What is that issue in terms of a major society's view of a community and people in terms of them being sub-persons? Here, in terms of chattel slavery in the United States, the Clayton and Byrd book is also equally important and valuable. Put that on your shelf if you don't already have it in terms of policy. I would also draw your attention to medical apartheid. You already know about this one. If you haven't, grab that. Put that on your shelf because these are essentially policies that take place in our system in terms of the healthcare industry, a $2.5 trillion industry. In Cincinnati, in terms of Jim Crow, of course, certainly if you go back, Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow, Eugene Robinson, his work in terms of disintegration, definitely take a look at that work because he's talking about first generation families, African descent, Nigerian, Ghana, Ethiopian, the Indian community, Asian community, what's taking place in St. George's County in D.C., et cetera. And, so definitely take a look at Eugene Robinson's piece, How Work Disappears by William Junius Wilson is also instructive in terms of the labor and wealth disparity here in Cincinnati, or in Cincinnati, in the 50s, but as late as 1965-66, you had this segregation that where African Americans were excluded from the hospitals. So 91% of all the deliveries in Cincinnati, 75% took place at the General Hospital, which is now University Hospital. The other roughly 10% was between Jewish Hospital and the Cincinnati, or the Catherine Booth Home and Hospital Burst. But out of those, the total number of deliveries, of 12,000 deliveries, there's only 3,000 deliveries in the African-American community. So that's instructive because in terms of this text here by E. Richard Brown, How Capitalism Influences and Affects Service Delivery, Colette talked about what's taking place in terms of persons of color not having participation in medical schools. You go today in medical schools as existed in 20 years ago, persons of African American descent, roughly 4 or 5 students in a class. University of Cincinnati, you won't see more than 2 African American students. You'll see Ethiopian students, you'll see Indian students, you'll see persons of African who come from Nigeria, Ghana, but you won't see very many African American students. That is not an accident, as opposed to what's taking place at even at Meharry and Morehouse, where we did much of our work. So in Cincinnati, in terms of the empirical evidence, what's taking place is that from 06 to 2010, the infant mortality rate for the citywide was 13.3. So what we did in terms of the health department, we drew a collaboration with the community health centers. 4 of the 5 community health centers participated in what we established as the Infant Vitality Surveillance Network. Over a 5-year period, 06 to 2010, the blue line is blue bar is essentially the IMR citywide. And then the dark blue is the surveillance network. So the aggregate IMR 06 to 2010 was 9.2 versus 13.6. What this represents, however, is that there are 5,300 deliveries, mean number of deliveries in Cincinnati over that same 5-year period. The surveillance network is only responsible for 820 deliveries. So we figure there are 4,400 deliveries. How can we have an impact or influence and hopefully scale it out so we can have a similar outcomes as we had in the surveillance network at 9.2. So again, to provide a little context here, infant deaths over that period, 356. There were more essentially infant deaths than homicides in Cincinnati during that same period. the core elements of the surveillance network is essentially we receive a monthly printout from the University Hospital, and this is also an advantage of the fact that community health centers, there's four community health centers that partner with us, the health department. University Hospital provides the OBGYN services for those respective community health centers. So we're able to acquire a monthly printout from deliveries from those respective community health centers as well as the health department. The care coordination component is extremely valuable. It's indispensable because here what we're talking about is the home visitation going in and providing certain interventions. And then additionally, the actual care experience, what's taking place in those respective health centers in terms of triaging high risk or what we identified greater risk clients, and when they get into a triage, we could talk about that in more detail in terms of smoking cessation, breastfeeding education, domestic abuse prevention, and things of that nature. So this is the actual buckets of information that we receive monthly, and that information is on a two-month lag. So we'll get information about payer source, if it's Buckeye, if it's CareSource, Molina, et cetera, and we'll know exactly what the prematurity rate is, the cesarean rate, et cetera, for each one of those providers, health plan providers. So that's a good thing. So I won't draw too much on that. Y'all are conversing with that, but it's just more importantly in terms of what kinds of specific delivery, care, specific information we're receiving on a two-month lag so that we can, again, engage in hopefully appropriate interventions to go upstream from the care experience. This more or less is just highlighting 2010. This is the health department, because normally folks will say, well, you know, in the African-American community, the infant mortality rate is twice as high as it is in the white community. Well, let's put things in perspective. Here, just note that for the health department, 56% here is the ratio proportion, and here is the respective infant mortality rates for 2010. That was 2010. So we did have a paper published, APHA. The health department is responsible for the delivery of the WIC program, roughly 12,000 clients. The upshot here is that for those individuals who are on WIC, overall the IMR was 8.6 versus if you're not on WIC, it was 10.2. If you're African American, the IMR was 9.6. If you were not on WIC, the IMR was 20.1. The upshot here for us is that the food, clothing, and shelter issues for the WIC program in terms of education was an extraordinary intervention, and we wanted to draw on that with our care experience in terms of the home visitation. So what we decided to do is that 4,400, how can we lay hands on those other 4,400 folks? Well, when we stratified the IMR by zip code, the zip code numbers for this period, 07 to 09, range from as low as 0 to as high as 32. Well, this is the aggregate IMR for the 24 zip codes. So what we decided to do, we identified those zip codes that had a 9.9 or less infant mortality rate. The aggregate for those 9 zip codes is 7.6. And for those zip codes that had 10 or higher, the aggregate IMR was 20.7. So that, in terms of numbers, is roughly 2,300 deliveries for those 15 zip codes. But when we implemented the First Steps program, it ballooned to 17 zip codes because we identified two other zip codes that we felt that we should dedicate attention to. This, again, to provide additional context, is that this is the Price Hill community. The Price Hill community in Cincinnati, we have a life expectancy that ranges in the 46 neighborhoods, as low as 66 and as high as 87.8. And so the Price Hill community is in a community where the life expectancy is around 66 years. There are two zip codes in that community. So for the health department, that's housed in this area, the Appalachian population, a largely Hispanic population, roughly a 40% African American population. The IMR for Price Hill was 6.2. We have one death. And again, for all of our health department centers, IMR was 9.3, city overall 12.6. The punchline here is that geography does play is a factor, but what's really a much more dominant factor for us, again, is that care experience, what takes place with that population in those particular areas. So you have before you is the flow chart for the First Steps program. What we elected to do in June, July of 2012, we approached three hospitals, those three delivery hospitals, which are responsible for 98% of all the deliveries in the city of Cincinnati. And we asked those three delivery hospitals to do five things: provide breastfeeding education, safe sleep education, depression screening, are you on WIC, and do you have a medical home? Those five things. Additionally, we approached the home visitation agencies and we asked them to do those same five things. Whenever Mrs. Jones, before Mrs. Jones is discharged into one of those 17 zip codes, the hospital would do the five interventions and the home visitation would do their five interventions. And we would receive a tracking form back from those respective hospitals and the home visitation agencies. And whatever they didn't do, then we would send out our home visitation folks to do whatever they didn't do. So if they didn't do the depression screening, we would do that. Two of the three hospitals elected to participate. Okay, so the prematurity piece, everyone is aware of the influence and the factor of prematurity in terms of infant mortality. I would simply state that, yeah, it's just like death from lung cancer. Okay, cigarettes cause lung cancer, but, you know, really, what we need to do is actually go before the issue in terms of not even picking up a cigarette, right? So the issue in terms of, okay, prematurity is a greater proportion of the deaths. You'll see on the death certificate, prematurity. But we want to go upstream. We want to deal with, okay, let's deal with nutrition, preconceptual health, reproductive health plans, and things of that nature. So let's not be intoxicated in terms of prematurity in itself. We recognize it exists, but we need to really go ahead upstream and deal with what is the reason for that prematurity. All right, so again, in terms of prematurity, this is, again, the health department and where our numbers are as opposed to Cincinnati overall. Again, the point here is that we always have to really zoom in on folks who are always using this racial kind of a thing as a line of demarcation. It's not about that. It's really, again, what is actually taking place? What kinds of interventions are we providing communities who have a higher risk exposures? And let's deal with those reasons for the risk exposures. Then, you know, clearly race is a factor, but it is not a dominant factor in our view. So in terms of actual numbers, this is in your handout as well, in terms of using 2008 as a baseline. We would subtract the numbers from each subsequent year, and the total number of preemies that we save from going into the NICU is 108. That amounts to $16 million to $31 million. Now, we talked about, at least we mentioned, in terms of capitalism and how that plays a role, NICU units. That is a profit center for a hospital. It's like the emergency room, profit center for hospitals. Okay, so I'm just putting that in your ear. We can talk about that in more detail. Again, this is the implementation of our First Steps program in 2013. And our goal that we established in June, July 2012 was an infant mortality rate citywide of 9.9 and 9.9 or lower in every zip code for every ethnic group or subpopulation in those respective zip codes. So here it shows the proportion, and this is in your handout as well. It shows the proportion of folks that received the depression screening, safe sleep, etc., roughly 89% received safe sleep, 84%. You can read that at your leisure. And so, citywide in 2013, Cincinnati achieved a 9.9 infant mortality rate. Citywide. That's the lowest it's ever been in modern history. 9.9. And for the health department, during that same year in 2013, that's on your sheet, the green highlights, blah, blah, blah. We had zero deaths out of the 435. We had zero deaths. I mean, that's unlikely. That's phenomenal, but, you know, clearly that we're not expecting zero deaths every year, but still, it is what it is. So the zero deaths, 9.9 for the city, that 13.6 during this five-year period, an extraordinary achievement. And also, in terms of the African-American population, for those who want to know, was 12.6 citywide. And, of course, zero for the health department. And also, I should say, in 2013, and several of the community health centers also had zero deaths. And so this is the actual numeric for each one of the zip codes. In 20, you can see the difference in terms of 06 to 2010. 2013, 11 out of the 17 zip codes had a decrease in IMR. 6 had an increase. Yeah, they had an increase in IMR, and 11 out of the 17 had a decrease. Some zip codes had zero. Again, we don't expect that to actually occur. And also for the statisticians, we know that there is, because of the smallness of the numbers, it's more likely for us to do things in terms of over a five-year period. But in order to determine the impact of the intervention, we're extremely pleased, no doubt, as to what took place in terms of the implementation of the First Steps program. This more or less, again, shows what the city of Cincinnati and compared to the other jurisdictions in Ohio. So we're doing quite well. We'll move on. Now, this is what we elected to do is that... folks talk about what the IMR is for different zip codes, talk about what the IMR for different ethnic groups and racial populations. Well, what's the IMR for hospitals? And here we have Hospital B in 2010, 8.5. You can see the aggregate number is 17.8, 15.922. Okay, so in 2013, this is for the double-digit zip codes, I should add. The double-digit zip codes, Hospital A, 13.9, B, 2.8, they have one death, and then Hospital C, 14.7. So again, you can get a sense as to what the IMR is for hospital specifics. And I think that's it. If you have any questions, we can entertain them during the quick Q&A.
Give a round of applause to all of our panelists. Are there any questions? Yes.
A lot of information, and in this case, they not the TV show, but they also collect the information on what kind of TV ads are being watched by a household. And then they sell this, you know, they sell this information to the food and beverage companies at a lot of money. And so we purchase the same set of data set that they use, and then they provide some of the demographic information, but they weren't exactly what we needed. So in the HDMA, the designated media market area, there are certain number of counties. So we went to the census and collected the information on the population from the census at the county level. And then we matched it to the DNA at the county level, and then we aggregated them up so that we knew exactly how many households, how many are black and Hispanic and white and non-white children, and so forth. Did I answer your question or what?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question was sort of, so the ad data came from Nielsen as well.
Yes.
And then I was curious in terms of if you know who in that county is watching the television, right? So not just who lives in the county, but different channels or different shows might have different target audiences. So who's watching that show might be different depending. And I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, my guess is that Nielsen also has the exact number, but what they do is that they instead of giving us that information, they calculate something called exposure measure. So they, I don't know exact formula they use, but it's an accepted number for the Nielsen. They calculate the say what the average kid would watch based on whatever information they have. And obviously they have the individual household numbers, but they don't let us have that.
Great, thank you.
Sure, no
problem. Additional questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. Obviously the Metro Holmes. He's a
teacher
at the medical school.
Me?
Yeah.
Colette.
No, I didn't evaluate those. That was just one of the factors that influenced people to not go into primary care. And I was pretty much saying that there are actually loan repayment programs and scenario analyses, which are pretty much studies that prove that you can actually become a PCP and live comfortably. So that's pretty much what I was saying.
Yeah, I was curious about that. And you mentioned that a lot of people were residents, so it's hard to say if they'll actually stay in those areas.
Yes. Possibly. So you're saying that students who practice in non-disadvantaged areas to have more money to pay back their loans, they only go there to pay their loans? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm wondering if you were able to observe if any of the students that were... So you didn't have any access to their information on their loans, right?
On their loans, no. No, I couldn't get that.
Yeah. No, I was wondering if you think it would be an interesting area for further study if we could increase funding to the loan that say I will pay back your loan if you work for 5 years in this disadvantaged area. Do you? I mean, it's a personal question.
Yeah, it would definitely influence people. The NHSC, which is the National Health Service Corps, actually does that. They take students, well, residents, and put them in disadvantaged areas, and they work for a certain amount of years, and they pay off a significant amount of their loans. I looked at analysis that showed that some of the programs actually paid back $140,000, $200,000, but it depended on how long they actually stayed in the program. So that is a great study to look at in the future, and I think it's very important because it's important to the primary care physician world because we need physicians, and I understand the fact that, you know, loans, most students have loans, and the loans are intense loans, meaning over $250,000, and you have to make a living, and you have to support your families, and you have to support yourself as far as our basic needs. We need food, clothing, and shelter, so sometimes that forces us to move into the non-disadvantaged areas, but yeah, I definitely understand what you're saying, and I understand the reasons why they would actually move into non-disadvantaged areas, and they would like to actually practice and in underserved communities. So, yeah, that's a great thing.
I just had a short comment. Sorry.
I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I do believe the Affordable Care Act actually stipulates something along the lines of, you know, if you're in a certain community, that you'll get some loan repayment. So I think that is helpful to move that agenda forward.
So I want to comment on your presentation, but it's also because of the ACA and as a personal background, I'm a physician myself from a disadvantaged.
Oh, well, thank you for your
so that's why I came to get but at the same token, so exactly what you're saying, like, I did my training in Texas, I'm Mexican American, one out of six children, like, very, you know, basically the thing is I practice in New York City and Harlem, more focused on HIV AIDS primary care. But the thing is, it's one of the reasons I practice in New York City versus Texas is because I don't feel like I can provide the care that I wanted to the population I wanted to serve. So I didn't try to be the doctor. I wanted to be in the U.S. in Texas, and that's why I practice in Mount Sinai in New York City. So it's also like disadvantage and comfort level. What are the things? So I'm very public health oriented. That's very difficult in Texas and many other states. I love your slide about empathy because I went to a session yesterday where someone was talking about teaching empathy.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm not trying to discount what you're saying, but what I'm trying to tell you is there's a difference you said about life story and being able to connect to your patient about that experience, about being able to connect in the way that you're able to say, yes, I understand you meet people halfway, but I understand why you have to go out of the food pantry. I understand why you can't control your high blood pressure. Because you're having to eat what you can.
Right.
So those are the things that I think I have lots of colleagues in Texas who are in private medicine, have people who are from what you would consider non-disadvantaged, but they still work in a disadvantaged community. So I think that you have to kind of, and the loan repayment, yes, that is one of my limitations as myself, is that what happens, like, you, this would be a great study to continue after residency, because as my colleagues do, medical school residency, life happens. So you have to start taking care of your family. You have to decide, like, what is it that you want to do and what's comfort for you and your family and your spouse and your kids.
Right.
And so the loan payments really do help because, yes, I have 200 plus loans. So it's a great study to continue, and I definitely would continue expanding it because of the ACA and because of the fact that there's so many of our generation that's continuing. And yeah, in my med school, there were lots of different disadvantaged communities, so it was different up there in Houston, which is where I trained.
Thank you
for your feedback and comments. That is time for our session. Again, a round of applause to